on Valdez?
No, the radar operator indicated that he attempted to acquire them on the 12-mile range, 12-mile scale, and was unable to.
Which operator are you referring to?
Mr. Taylor.
And he didn't pick up the Exxon Valdez on the 12-mile scale?
I think that's what he said, yes.
When Mr. Taylor testified the other day, he stated that he was unaware of the identity of his immediate supervisor. You mentioned earlier these payday meetings that you have every 2 weeks. Would you care to comment on that statement that he made?
I think Mr. Taylor was confused on the word supervisor. There's a watch supervisor, there's the OOD that's a supervisor, there's a supervisor on a civilian performance appraisal form. It's a kind of a generic term. I just think he got confused.
On the evening of the 23rd, if Mr. Taylor had viewed the Exxon Valdez, if the Exxon Valdez had requested permission to deviate from the traffic separation scheme, does he have the authority to grant that permission?
Totally depart the scheme, or like the vessel did, go to the inbound lane and go across the separation zone into the inbound lane?
Leave the traffic separation scheme.
Completely.
Yes, sir.
He should not have granted that permission himself. He should have passed that up the line. At that time, after hours, it would have been to the OD, who would have either contacted myself or the exec.
The OD that night, was he on station?
At that time at night, probably not. He probably went home.
So what are the procedures when there's no OD available?
Well, he's available. He just wasn't physically at the station.
So the process is to contact the OD, and he would make a decision?
That's the normal process. If the watchstander felt there was an immediacy to it, he could have contacted the XO or myself directly, which, in fact, that's what Mr. Blanford did direct. He contacted me direct, which is an acceptable situation.
Are the OD's watchstander qualified?
By watchstander qualified, do you mean?
I'm talking about vessel traffic control watchstander qualified.
Right. I mean, yeah, but I'm still not sure. Do you mean qualified to operate the radar or qualified to understand the operations of the vessel traffic side?
What I mean is qualified to stand the watch so that he can make a decision as to the situation that was evolving.
To make a decision, yes. To operate the radar equipment, no. They are not radar trained. Some of them are, some of them aren't, depending on what their basic rating is. But the majority of them are not qualified to operate the radar sets.
So would that make them less qualified than the actual watchstander that's requesting guidance?
Not in the policy matters, only in the technical aspect of using the equipment.
Because of the memo dated 31 August 7, Delta, could that possibly have been the reason why the Exxon Valdez was not followed out that evening? The policy not to plot outside the Narrows?
No.
Next several questions I have, Commander, is regarding the qualifications of watchstanders. Shortly after the ground, the Exxon Valdez, we interviewed you at the MSO Valdez. And you stated that Mr. Blanford and Mr. Taylor qualified as vessel traffic controllers based on their prior VTS experience obtained in the Coast Guard. Is that correct? Is that a correct interpretation of what you said?
That's what got them high ranking on the OPM listing of prospective employees, yes.
Does the Coast Guard encourage hiring ex-vessel traffic controllers for these civilian positions that they've created? Is there a preference?
I don't know the answer to that, Coast Guard wide.
What type of training is required of newly hired qualified vessel traffic controllers? When I say qualified, they meet the requirements of OPM.
Once they arrive at that MSO Valdez?
That's correct.
They have to take rules of the road examinations, familiarization, tanker ride.
Is that a single tanker ride?
It's preferred that they have an annual re-tanker, an annual ride of a tanker for refamiliarization or requalification, as it says in the manual here. It's become a somewhat of a problem, not so much with the military side, but with getting overtime for training purposes for the civilian employees to do that.
Actually, I was making reference to the initial qualifications, not the requal. I was going to get to that shortly. What is required is of a newly hired vessel traffic controller who is attempting to qualify as a non-supervised watchstander.
Tanker ride, rules of the road examination, knowledge of the VTS regulations and the operations and current navigation practices, ship handling. It's as laid out in 2.4.1 of the initial qualification in the manual there.
The examination that you refer to, is that an open book examination?
Open book, rules of the road, yes.
Is the rest of the examination open book? It's more of a study guide?
Yes, I believe so.
And you say there's only one single tanker ride required?
Familiarization, yes.
For initial qualification.
Yes, familiarization with what goes on the bridge of a tanker and on a tugboat, yes.
When we're talking about requalification, what is your policy on requalification?
We would like to have the vessel watchstanders take one ride on a tanker, one ride on a tug annually. For refamiliarization with what it is like, on the bridge, on the wheelhouse of a tug, or on the wheelhouse of a tanker.
What are the consequences if the watchstander is unable to fulfill these standards? In other words, these are standards. These are required. Is that correct?
Correct. By consequences, I'm not sure what you mean.
According to your manual, which is, like you noted earlier, has been updated, it's the latest version, November 88. In order to be to maintain your qualification as a watchstander, the way I interpret this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that you would have to take one deep draft ride through the Valdez Narrows and one tug escort ride. Mm-hmm. My question is, if a watchstander does not make these trips, does that make that individual technically not qualified to be a watchstander?
No.
What is the reason for having these requalification rides as a requirement?
For refamiliarization with what it is like in the wheelhouse of a tanker on a tug, to give the individual watchstander more of a feeling for what activities are going on the other end of the microphone that he's talking to, or on the other end of the image on the radar scope.
So do you feel that this is a very important part of their training?
It's important. The weight of its importance would vary with the individual, I would believe, the watchstander, individual watchstander. Our civilians, our long-term residents, so to speak. They don't get transferred out every 2 years as the military would if they're single, or 3 years if they're married. The watch standards that we have now are very familiar with the geographics, very familiar with the area. But it's important for them, but it's more important for the military side, the folks that are not as familiar with the local geographics and the local conditions in Valdez.
But it's also true that many of the military have been assigned here for several years, is that correct?
2 years. 2 years on the average. Most of them, well, two or three, yes.
Commander, prior to the day of the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, had any of your watch standers actually taken any requalification rides since their initial qualification?
I don't know. I don't know off the top of my head.
Any of your military watch standers haven't taken any out either?
I said I don't know. I don't know exactly.
The next several questions will be on the area of ice conditions in the Valdez Arm. Commander, prior to the accident, did you perceive that an ice threat or problem existed in the Valdez Arm?
We know that there's ice occasionally in Valdez Arm, and that it does present an item that the outbound and inbound traffic should be notified of.
How does the Coast Guard monitor the ice conditions in the vicinity of Bly Island?
Presently, the monitoring is done via communications with the outbound and inbound tankers and other vessels, ferries, cruise ships, cargo ships.
Is this reporting mandatory?
Reporting of ice?
The way I'm interpreting what you're saying is the vessels are reporting these ice reports. What is their motivation for reporting these, making these reports? Is it mandatory?
I'm not sure what you mean by mandatory. Is it mandatory that they report, or?
Are you relying on the vessels transiting Prince William Sound as being cooperative? I mean, have you asked them to make these reports? Or have you required them to make the reports?
Oh, no, yes, we've asked them to make the reports, and they have. They've been been giving us reports.
Now, during earlier testimony, it's been stated that the between 3 and 4 transits a day pass through Valdez Arm, is that correct?
Of oil tankers?
Yes. So is it conceivable that many hours would go by before you'd have an opportunity to get an ice report?
Potentially, yes.
Would you characterize these ice reports as being somewhat subjective in nature? What I mean by that is that it would vary from individual to individual based on his past experience transiting the sound.
Yes, most definitely.
So any two people reporting the same ice conditions might have a different interpretation of what they're saying, is that correct?
Possibly, yes.
Once an ice report is received, how long does the Coast Guard consider that report valid?
I'd say it's only as valid or as valid as long as until the next vessel comes along and either substantiates it or mitigates it.
Does a VTC watch standard actually request vessels to provide an ice report?
Yes, we ask them to.
Commander, do you recall what time the ARCO Juno transited the Valdez Arm the afternoon or early evening on the 23rd. Do you recall what time that was?
The exact time, I'm not sure. I think it's been referred to as being 3 or 4 hours prior to the Exxon Valdez.
Is that 3 or 4 hours prior to the departure from Alyeska Terminal, or is that 3 or 4 hours from the time of the grounding?
I think that was 3 or 4 hours prior to the transit of the Exxon Valdez through the Narrows.
So when Captain Murphy received the ICE report from the VTC, which was approximately 9 o'clock, and they stated then that the report was several hours old at that time, is that correct?
I'm not sure.
What I'm leading up to, Commander, is that when the Exxon Valdez ran aground, is it conceivable that 6 to 8 hours might have passed since the last vessel had passed through there?
No, I think the time frame is still within 3 to 4 hours. But I see what you're saying, but I'm not sure that's correct. I'd still say within 3 or 4 hours.
Were there any other ICE reports received by the Coast Guard that evening?
Not that I'm aware of.
I'd like to place a somewhat hypothetical situation before you, if it's out of line in any way. Let me know. If a master departed the Alyeska Terminal without an ICE report, because there hadn't been any traffic in Valdez Arm, and he encountered heavy ice, what is that master to do? What would you recommend that he try to do?
I would expect the master to use his best judgment and advise the VTC on his actions.
The point I'm making, Commander, is that he never had any opportunity to find out what the ice condition was in advance. In other words, it's after the fact, and I was just wondering if you had any comment on that.
No, that's...
Commander, is the Port of Valdez ever been closed, or the inbound traffic ever halted because of ice that you're aware of?
I don't believe it's ever been closed because of ice. Now, tanker traffic may have been slowed up because of vessels slowing down, but I can't recall ever being closed by myself, for ice. Now, pilots may have, delayed sailings, or companies or masters may have delayed their sailing time because of reports, but I can't recall ever officially closing the port for ice, no.
Commander, you assumed your position in summer of 85, is that correct?
July of 1985, yes.
And who was the previous CO of MSO Valdez?
Commander Cavett, Michael Cavett.
When he briefed you, did he mention anything about the ice becoming more of a problem in Valdez Arm?
What I remember him briefing me on is there was a 16-millimeter film that showed the Columbia Glacier in motion. It was one of the high topics of discussion in 1985, I guess, about Columbia Glacier maybe beginning to start its retreat, but there was no major concern expressed by him that I can recall about ice, but we only overlapped for a couple of days.
I'd like to call your attention to Exhibit 13B, Bravo, page 6. This is a situation report that originates in MSO Valdez. I believe it's August 8th, 1984. And according to the SITREP, during the period of 30th July to 7 August 1984, they talk about an unusual large number of icebergs drifting across Columbia Bay and into Valdez Arm across the traffic lanes. As a consequence, the SITREP reports that 18 tank ships, 18 in 1 week, approximately 1 week, required diverting from the traffic scheme and or reducing speed due to ice conditions. Were you aware of that condition at all?
No, I wasn't. You know, not in that specific count, 18 tankers. You know, Commander Cuvette and I only had several days overlap, but there was a, you know, the remaining office staff was there. And I believe, you know, there was concern expressed, obviously, about occasional ice coming out and tankers having to divert, but it was nothing that was deemed critical at the time for major action other than, you know, than alerting.
I'd like to call your attention on the same exhibit, page 7. This is a SITREP that was issued from 17th District. And I call your attention to the comment they make in the middle of paragraph A. Tankers are diverting out of the traffic lanes and navigating within 500 yards of Bly Reef Buoy to remain clear of the ice. Would you consider that amount of ice to be a hazard of navigation?
I'd say any ice is a hazard to navigation.
My question is then, under what circumstances would the Port of Valdez be closed on the account of ice?
I don't know.
And how would you know how bad the ice situation is? Does the Coast Guard have any resources for monitoring the ice in the vicinity of Boyle Island?
No facilities in place other than, you know, we could request an overflight, request a vessel to give on-site observations. But there is no constant, like a video camera type thing, there's no observation system in place.
You mentioned a video camera. Would the video camera placed in the vicinity of Boyle Island be able to see entirely across the arm?
Depending on weather conditions and the type of the camera, yes.
If the Coast Guard provided overflights, where would the flights be originating from?
Well, that would depend on the time of the year. During the winter, they'd originate out of Kodiak. During the summer season, there is an aviation support facility at Cordova that has a helicopter assigned to it.
I'd like to call your attention again to Exhibit 13 Bravo, page 10. This is a letter from Commander Woodle, who was a previous CO before Commander Cavett, I believe. Paragraph 3. They talk about a period of July of October 1981 where they observed the largest concentration of ice enter the VTS traffic lanes since the service began in 77. Based on this letter and the SITREPs that I indicated earlier, would you say that ice is more of a problem today or that it has been a problem all along?
I'd say seasonally, ice has been a concern since, at least since 81, since he expressed his concern here, yes.
When you say seasonally, what months of the year would you be referring to?
I'd say more in the summer months.
Are you aware of any of the oil companies actually ordering or limiting their tank vessels to operating during daylight hours during this period, 1981. Are you aware of them ever doing that?
Yeah, see, it says it here in the letter, but I am not aware of it. Well, I was not aware of it until I read the letter.
I mentioned earlier that the SITREP reports originated, one of them originated from the 17th District. During your 4 years as CO, or have you ever received any inquiries or discussed with anybody at district headquarters regarding the possibility of the ice becoming more of a problem in the Valdez Arm?
There's been discussions. Phone conversations. I usually weekly report to Juno the activities of the past week and anticipated activities of the next week. And during several of those discussions, I'm sure the subject of ice in Valdez Arm has come up.
I'm going to switch topics on you, Commander, and I have a couple on the equipment, the radar equipment. Since the accident, have there been any equipment modifications, adjustments, or repairs to the Raytheon radar? And if so, could you explain what they were and why?
Well, since the casualty, we've had electronic support staff from Ketchikan come up and do an evaluation and check on the radars, and they found them to be in tune and operating properly. Some of the techniques that my personnel were using were, I guess they described it as the long way to get it done, but they were proper techniques, and the equipment was found working satisfactorily.
Are you familiar with field change number 2?
Yes.
Has field change number 2 been implemented before or after the accident?
After the accident.
Could you describe the advantages or disadvantages of field change number 2?
Well, the advantages of field change number 2 is that now you can have the Potato Point site both give you a 3 mile and under radar image and a 6 mile and above radar image on two separate indicators.
So the bottom line is you could view both the Narrows and the Valdez Arm at the same time. Is that the net result?
That's a general term when you say Valdez Arm. Valdez Arm at 6 mile scale, 12 mile scale, you could always evaluate Valdez Arm at the 6 mile scale and the 3 mile scale without any problem. 3 mile and 12 mile obviously gave you the problem. But all the operators knew that, and to monitor Valdez Arm, you either had it on the 6 and the 12 or the 3 and the 6. You couldn't have it on the 3 and the 12 before. Now you can.
Has the Coast Guard implemented any study or review of the VTS in MSO Valdez?
Study and review. We're acquiring more data again, just like you had requested. The Commandant has asked us to acquire some plotting data, I think, to determine basically the reliable range of the radars and find out what the radars are capable of over the long term, how far out we can see, and what is the actual necessity, how far out should we see.
Has a report been generated as a result of that study?
Not by my office, no.
Are you aware of any report?
There's been a lot of folks visiting, gathering information, and I imagine there's a lot of reports being generated, but I haven't seen any reports yet.
I just have one additional question regarding field change number 2. Are field changes mandatory? Are they?
I've asked that question myself because I was unaware of that change until the recent events. Apparently, those field changes are not mandatory, as I understand it today.
Thank you, Commander. I don't have any further questions.
Thank you, Rich, Mr. Johnson. Captain Deppe.
You're listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearing in Anchorage, brought to you by KSK Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. On the stand is Captain Steve McCall, Commander Steve McCall, Captain of the Port of Port of Valdez for the U.S. Coast Guard. He's being questioned by Captain William Deppe from Exxon.
On the next scale, and he saw the vessel very clearly, and he could even tell what direction the vessel was facing. Can you explain the inconsistency between those two?
Well, the best way I can explain it is, aside from having the, when Mr. Taylor was monitoring the ship, it was an outbound laden tanker giving a stern on, or stern part port quarter on image to the radar scope. When Mr. Taylor looked at the Exxon Valdez, I mean, when Mr. Blanford looked at the Exxon Valdez, 45 minutes or so, or almost an hour later, I guess, well, 45 minutes later, he was looking at a 1,000-foot long broadside view, which much more would have much more reflective surface on it.
Yeah. Yeah, Commander McCall, the Exxon Valdez is a VLCC, very big beam. Very high structure. Whether it was a beam of the radar or stern to the radar, it seems like it should be a pretty big radar target. Is it possible that Mr. Taylor just, once it got beyond the 6-mile scale, just stopped monitoring the vessel and didn't really lose it in the radar screen?
No.
If the Valdez was tracked as far as Bly Reef with the overlays in use, in your opinion, do you think that information could have been passed from the VTC to the vessel that might have prevented this grounding?
No. The VTC passes information to a ship that he wouldn't normally already have. It's already been stated that the ship basically knew where he was, off Busby Island, could see Bly Reef buoy. There was no information the VTS could have given him that would have helped the situation any.
Commander McCall, let's change subjects to the response in the first 24 hours. Can you list all the federal agencies you had to deal with personally during the first 24 hours after the Valdez grounded?
Personally, does that include the members of the RRT who we were in teleconference
That's
with?
That's correct, yeah.
The Coast Guard, the state of Alaska, represented by the Department of Environmental Conservation and Fish and Wildlife, Department of Interior, Department of Commerce, EPA, I may have missed one, but that's basically the agencies.
Were there any other agencies that the Coast Guard was dealing with that you didn't deal with personally, but other members of your staff might have been dealing with?
This is federal or state?
Yeah, both federal and state. Okay.
Well, we, well, that's Fish and Wildlife, but the state trooper. No, I can't think of any.
About how many meetings did you have during that first 24 hours with different organizations and groups?
Well, the RRT teleconference taking place about 11:30 noon. Meetings over the phone, talking with people from Alyeska, people from Exxon. And then a meeting over at Alyeska before we got on the helicopter to go to go use the dispersants on Friday. And that's basically it, I think.
You just had, so how many was that?
One, two, three, I guess, three.
Three meetings?
Three live meetings, and then, like I say, a lot over the telephone.
And do you have any idea about how many telephone calls and radio calls you might have made that first day?
No, I can't say for sure. We've got, you know, three of our telephone, well, we've got to share the telephone bills, with, which would list that. And radio calls, many.
And do you have any idea how many people you met that first day and talked to?
Quite a few. It's hard to narrow it down to numbers.
It's just safe to say you were real busy that first day. A lot of conversations, meetings, calls.
A lot of activity, yes.
Okay. Can you tell me when you first contact or meeting with representatives of the state of Alaska regarding the oil spill?
About 0100 in the morning. I spoke to Dan Lawn, the local representative of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Was he the prime contact with the state during the first 24 hours?
Yes, he's the local ADEC rep in Valdez, and who we have worked with, over the past years.
Is there anyone else from the state that you dealt with during that first 24 hours?
Well, because Dan Lawn went out on the Exxon Valdez, several of his staff members, and I think I was in phone conversation or talked to Bill Lamoureux, Dan Lawn's immediate supervisor in Anchorage.
Did any of the contacts with the state deal with the use of dispersants to combat the spill?
Yes.
And could you tell who that contact was with about dispersants?
Well, at the RRT meeting, where I think Bill Lamoureux, Mr. Lamoureux was at, it was discussed there amongst all the agencies. I think I mentioned it to Dan Lawn at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Was anyone else present during these conversations?
For the RRT meeting, yes, a lot of people. Telephone calls, they were recorded, some of them. So.
During that RRT meeting that took place around noontime, I believe it was, dispersants were discussed there. Was approval for dispersants given at that point?
Basically, the RRT had concurred, or their concurrence or their general agreement to the fact that dispersant use was worth a try.
So approval was given at that first RRT meeting to use dispersants on the spill?
Basically, yes. Yes, within that time frame. Between there, yes.
Okay, and who was that communicated to after the RRT decided?
I was passed along to Alyeska.
That first helicopter dispersant test that took place, who witnessed that test?
Myself.
And how did you determine that the test was unsatisfactory?
By visual observations. There was no interaction between the dispersant in the oil and the water. There was a state of Alaska had a plane up, or helicopter or plane, I forget which now, but they had an aircraft up. And they basically drew the same conclusions also.
you know if the state ever requested from the Coast Guard to take over the spill response within the first 24 hours?
That the state wanted to take it over, or the state
State requested the Coast Guard to take it over.
I don't recall.
Did the state ever request to take over the spill response itself?
No, I don't believe so.
Commander Paul, what were your responsibilities in dealing with the news media as far as, or public affairs in regarding this incident?
I'd attend several news conferences. On that first day, I was so busy, I didn't participate in any of the news conferences. I assigned my first class yeoman, John Gonzalez, to do a lot of that until we could get a public affairs support team up from 17th Coast Guard District.
Okay. Commander McCall, do you have any training in oil spill response techniques or experience in those things also?
Yes, basically from starting out in 1973 at the Marine Safety Office in Albany, New York, you know, we'd average about 600 reportable oil spills a year.
With your experience, do you believe that a spill of this magnitude could have been cleaned up solely by mechanical means?
That's a hard question to answer with the hindsight we have now. Early on, when the oil was first released through Friday, and I know it's going beyond the first 24 hours, but there was perfect weather for mechanical recovery of oil, and a lot of equipment en route, above and beyond Alyeska's initial response. I know I mentioned, I think, at one of the news conferences, in agreement with Mr. Irasi, that it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of possible options. Dispersants was one of the options that might have worked had the conditions and the situation warranted. I didn't really answer your question, but it's a difficult decision to say. Probably not.
I've just got a few more questions about the VTS. And Exhibit 13B, I don't think you have to get it out. I'll just read you one little paragraph on here. It's the last page, and it's signed by Mr. Woodall. And it's paragraph 4. It says, with the current U.S. Geological Survey predictions for continued increases in calving of Columbia Glacier over the next 10 to 30 years, placement of a radar site either on Glacier Island or Bly Island could prove to be invaluable tool during the iceberg season, June to November. Has any action ever been taken to put a radar on one of those two locations?
Not that I'm aware of.
If the VT watchstander was tracking the Exxon Valdez outbound and he was using the overlays and he saw the Exxon Valdez exit the traffic lane and exit the whole separation system, would he have routinely made a phone call to the, or a radio call to the Valdez and informed him that he was outside the traffic system?
He most certainly would have, yes.
Well, you said earlier that there's no way in the world that the traffic controller could have prevented this grounding from occurring. If he had made a radio call like that, do you think that might have been a way that could have shaken the third mate out of his doldrums and maybe gotten them to change course sooner?
There's a lot of speculation in that question. I believe that had the watchstander contacted him, been able to contact him, and based on the situation you just presented, the ship would have acknowledged that they knew they were outside the lanes, which they already admitted they were. So the watchstander would have just got a roger that, and he would have been watching them on the scope.
Commander McCall, Exhibit 7A. Which is page 18 of the VTC manual. It states that it gives examples of radio transmissions, and it states that vessel traffic controllers can direct vessels. I'll read one of them to you right here. It's towards the bottom, the third paragraph from the bottom. It says, Trenton, this is Valdez traffic. Our radar shows you 100 yards to the left of traffic lane inside the separation zone. You are directed to take corrective action. Over. Yeah, and directed right there is capitalized. Mm-hmm. That seems to be an example of a transmission where the traffic center was directing a vessel to take some sort of action. In the case of the Valdez, if they had received a transmission such as this, do you think that could have avoided this grounding?
No, because you're taking this communications out of context. The way this communication with the Trenton is envisioned is this is a vessel in the separation zone, probably on a direct course with an inbound tanker or something. You know, it's a particular situation. There, the watchstander already knew about the fact that the Exxon Valdez was going to be diverting across the separation zone, maybe into the inbound lane. All he would have been doing was to notifying them, alerting him to the fact that our radar, you know, with our overlay, indicated he would have been outside the traffic separation scheme.
Okay, just one more, Commander. The next page of the manual there, page 19, the first paragraph on where it states the function of the VTC. Mm-hmm. And I'll read you the pertinent part here. It says the VTC should recognize potential trouble spots and recommend against any practice which could result in danger of collision or grounding. In certain circumstances, recommendations will not be sufficient and it will be necessary for the VTC to direct or prohibit vessel movement. Don't you agree that that's one of the functions of the VTC, to prohibit actions that could prevent a grounding?
Within the scope of information the VTS has available to it, yes.
Okay, thanks, Commander. That's all good.
Mr. Howitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commander McCall, yesterday Larry Shire, the Marine Manager of the Valdez Terminal, testified regarding his concern for the weather conditions at the time that the barge was being loaded in immediate response to the accident. And in particular, he talked about the darkness, the ice and snow conditions, which he had to consider in order to safely load and to lash down the cargo on the contingency barge in those early morning hours. As the OSC, do you share his concerns that the pollution response activities need to be carried out with the highest regard for the safety of the people involved?
Most definitely.
Carrying on with that, was it important to you as the OSC that the initial response be carried out without loss of life or personal injury to the personnel involved?
Yes.
I believe earlier today in your testimony, Mr. Kacharian quoted you as saying that Alyeska's initial response was a little slow. As the OSC, would you be willing to trade off the safety of the people involved for a more rapid response time?
I think I'd like to phrase my answer as saying I expect the response to be done as rapidly as possible within the realm of personnel safety.
Given the enormity and the instantaneous nature of this spill, did you concur with Alyeska's decision to load additional equipment and supplies beyond those required in the contingency plan?
At the time of the response, I was unaware that they were loading extra equipment on board. But the fact that, you know, more equipment was on board and more equipment got out there when it did get out there is obviously an enhancement to the oil spill recovery.
In the early morning hours, and I believe it's at 4:45 a.m., and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you advised Alyeska that the Coast Guard's top priority was lightering. Is that correct?
I don't know if I said our top priority. I think that's I considered it a high priority.
And why was that?
Of a major concern expressed to me by my people on scene, Commander Falkenstein, for the safety of the vessel itself, for getting the million barrels, or making an attempt to get some of the remaining million barrels of oil off, was, again, at the time, a high priority because of the uncertainty of the situation with the vessel. That was at 4 something in the morning?
Yes, I believe it was at 4:45 a.m.
See, we still hadn't gone through the complete tide cycle of low tide, which was at 8:30, which was very critical. Once that 8:30 time frame came around and we had gone through a low tide, the leakage of the oil slowed down and stopped pretty much with the incoming tide, but we also had a little better feeling for the status of the vessel, whether it was going to come off the rock or what it was going to do. But at 4:30, we were very, very uncertain, and the vessel was making a lot of unfamiliar sounds.
Did you request any additional lightering equipment or any special lightering equipment from Alyeska beyond that would normally be taken out? Or did you convey any particular lightering equipment?
I'm not sure what you would have normally brought out, but we requested the Yokohama fenders, the lightering fenders that would go between two vessels to cushion them from each other.
I'd like to change subjects on you a little bit here and talk about in-situ burning. You talked about the RRT, discussing that, is that correct?
Yes, that was done Friday morning, noon.
And the RRT approved a decision?
I believe the RRT concurred that we should attempt it when the equipment arrived, and all that was needed was the burn permit from the state.
Do you know what conditions were imposed by the ADEC in the burn permit for the in-situ burning?
No, not really, not now. No, I don't know. I can't recall them, put it that way.
Okay, thank you. I have just three more questions. Yesterday, I believe, or perhaps the day before, Lieutenant Commander Falkenstein testified that at the time of the arrival of the Alyeska equipment, the barges and the skimmers, that the proper location for deployment would be at or near the leading edge of the spill, which was considerably to the southwest of the location of the Exxon Valdez. Would you concur with that judgment?
At that time, yes. the ship had stopped leaking, and the oil was slowly advancing in the southwesterly direction.
How would you characterize the working relationship between your office, yourself, and for the Coast Guard, and Alyeska, both before and after the accident?
Good. We, communicate regularly, freely. My personnel have, have access to the terminal and go about doing their vessel boardings and inspections.
Have you ever experienced difficulty in accessing the terminal to do your work?
No.
Thank you very much, Commander McCall.
Dr. Laresh.
Commander McCall.
Bob Laresh will be asking questions for the State of Alaska. You're listening to live coverage of the NTSB hearings from the Captain Cook Hotel in downtown Anchorage.
On telephone, that they should consider mobilizing for dispersant use. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And in response to that, Alyeska gave you or the RRT team an application by fax about 8:30 that morning.
Yes.
And when was the permission then following the RRT team meeting for this trial application? That came what time of the day?